This is Matias Correa of Two Wheel South in Brooklyn, New York. You're listening to Fly here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
You are listening to Fly here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Melissa Rodway, and today on the show I have Matias Correa. In 2016-2017, Matias and his friend Joel Estopa drove two BMW motorbikes from Brooklyn, New York to Ushuaia, Argentina, the southernmost city in the continent. They covered 13 countries, driving over 20,000 miles for over 6 months. They've come back with numerous stories, as well as a beautiful book and website, both called Two Wheels South. Matias was born in Spain, in Barcelona. He is a man of the world and joins us via Skype from Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to Fly, Matias.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
Yeah, we've had a few hard times getting connected, so we've got to make this count, don't we? So we spoke about how you were born in Barcelona.
I actually was born and raised in Barcelona, but my family is from Argentina. I've been to Argentina just a few times, and basically I didn't know more than Brazil and Argentina from the entirety of South America. And I hadn't really been to Central America, which is part of the reason of taking the trip, to go into places I didn't know.
Absolutely. Wow. So that's very interesting. So even as a little kid, your parents, you never visited Argentina to visit family or anything like that?
Just a few times when I was a child, you mostly up to maybe 14, 15, 16 years old. You know, it's a very different perception of the place. And also you go to a city, we go to Buenos Aires or Rosario, which are, you know, main cities. And that is not the country itself. That's just two metropolis. So,
yeah.
I wanted to see the rest of the countries.
And we're speaking to you now from Brooklyn, New York. So how did you end up there?
So I've been in New York for now, it's about to be 18 years. And I ended up here because I was a little, you know, after school, I worked for a year and so, but I was a little bored, to be honest. I wanted a little bit more of excitement. I wanted to sort of learn to speak English. I wanted to see how, you know, the Americans did design, and New York has always been a city that had a lot of appeal to me because, one, jazz, and I play saxophone and I love jazz since I was a teenager, and two, design, and, you know, New York City has both of those things as prominent cultural sort of characteristics of its, you know, of its core, you know, like New York City is jazz and definitely has design as part of it. So I just thought it was a great place to be for a couple of years. I thought it was going to be a couple of years. But then when I came here, third year one, I fell in love. And you know, the rest is history. I've been here for 18 years.
Oh, yeah. I love New York. I don't typically go to too many places more than once. But New York, I've been to probably 8, 9, 10 times because I love it.
I know how it feels.
It's exciting. Yeah. And so you are a graphic designer by trade. That's your career?
I'm a graphic designer by trade, but then in 2005-06, I started a tech company with a partner called Behance and sort of transitioned into the digital design world, so a product designer of sorts, so designing all sorts of digital products. So I moved from the physical graphic design into more complex moving systems of digital environments. So.
How did you go from this working guy living it up in New York City to deciding that you needed to jump on a bike and head to the furthest point in South America possible? What led you to that?
Well, it was a few things. After almost, I think, 14 years of being in New York City and almost 9 years of building my company, building a company is very taxing, it's very demanding. And to be honest, I saw 9 years of my life, as rewarding as they were and as much as I learned, you see life passing by because it's New York City, you're working really hard. And I decided to leave that behind as a sort of as a personal move. You know, we were lucky that the company did well, and then I wanted to sort of step back and see what I wanted to do with my life. And that was a big change. So after that, though, 5 months later, my sister Soledad passed away. And that sort of threw me for a loop. And the mix between sort of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life and then the death of my sister really made me look at life in a very different way. And what happened is that I sort of really looked inside and say, what would I regret if I died tomorrow? And what I regret, and I saw it clearly, is never have done this trip that I've been sort of brewing for almost 18 years with my friend Joel. We talked about it for 18 years. And I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm doing this. That's the only thing I want to do. That's the most important thing that I need to accomplish now. And I'm not scared of death. I was never, you know, fearful of that. It's just that I felt that that was a great step. And in many ways, the previous months to that decision, I was a little bit in darkness, sort of looking for answers. And once I decided that, I saw a certain element of light and direction and purpose, to be honest, you know. And suddenly, instead of floating around in my grief in many ways, I suddenly like saw the path, you know, the road. And I called Joel. And we've talked about this so much. And we were always, oh, wait, when can we do it? And everything got, you know, in the way for so many years. And when I said, hey, I'm leaving October 12th, I called him in Barcelona. I said, I'm leaving October 12th. Are you coming? And he said, yes. And I think the motion of me making the decision and telling him, hey, I'm doing this. In many ways, with or without you, I wanted to go with him, of course. And I wanted him to be excited. And I think my motion of saying, hey, I'm doing this, are you in? Push him, you know, to say yes. And it was, you know, that's how I got to start prepping for this trip.
And so you had picked the date of October 12th, but what date or what month was it when you made this decision? And why did you pick October 12th?
I think I picked the date around February, March. It gave us March, April, May, June, July, August, October. It's made 6 months to prepare. I thought that was enough, but at the same time, what the first thing I did before I called Joel is because I looked at the weather maps, you know, the sort of the weather patterns, and I realized that October here, it's okay, and it's not too cold, but it's also October, November, December is already getting hot in the southern hemisphere. So basically, I look at the time that you leave, so October, and the time that I can get there. I think 6 months with a mix between my visa status, Joel's amounts of time that he could leave, and sort of like, people have done it in 3 months. People have done it in a year. We thought 6 months made sense. Joel also was in a relationship at the same time. So there was certain things that decided us to make it in 6 months. But also March in the southern hemisphere is the end of summer. So that pattern just worked. So that's why I decided on October 12th. And October 12th, I don't know why 12th, to be very honest. I just don't know. Just a date. You know, you got to think something. It doesn't become concrete.
Yep, I totally can relate to that in my own life. Let's talk about your friendship with Joel. So obviously he's a friend that you had in childhood. He's living in Barcelona, you're in New York. Why did you know this was something that you could do with him?
Well, Joel and I have been, you know, loving vintage BMWs since I saw his vintage 1974 BMW R6/6. I then fell in love with BMWs. We were, I think, 19 years old. Since then, I was completely hooked to these type of motorcycles. So we shared this love for this vintage, old, rudimentary, beautifully styled motorcycles. And then we took a trip, very much like Motorcycle Diaries, from Barcelona to the south of Spain. Very small trip, maybe like 1,000 kilometers. But that sort of triggered everything. We realized how beautiful it was to be on the road and be with someone sharing that. And that one was with two people on one bike, two up. And since then, we started talking about it. And Joel is a curious man. He's a traveler. He's not a tourist. He speaks 5 languages, you know. And we just laugh so hard together, you know. And what else do you want? Joel and I love wine and love food and sort of love discovering new places. And I think it's just in my mind, I couldn't think about a better person to do that than him. It was sort of like an obvious choice, mix between friendship, motorcycles, and sort of, and we're not similar, by the way, we're very different humans, but I think that's what makes a good couple, a good partnership in the travel, and also in like, as friends, is amazing.
Yeah, and you're still friends, so that's a good sign, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that was the question. And I have to say, I don't think we ever got in an argument. I think at some point, each one of us had to yell at the sky and throw a rock or, you know, be angry, but not at each other. I don't think we ever got angry at each other. We're partners. We're doing this together. You know, I've known Joelle since we were 15. Mm. There's no surprises there anymore. You know, that's the secret, I think. Not that we love everything about each other. That's not the point, neither truth. It's that we know everything in that sense.
Yeah.
What is happening in his brain, and I see it, I know, so I can do something about it, or I can ignore it, meaning let him do his thing. Same thing with me. We all have our moments, and in journeys like this, things get heightened, but you know, because we love each other and because we respect each other, we know how to deal with each other, and it's very beautiful.
I saw on your website that you have several very impressive people on there who have already done this kind of journey. So a few of them were women, and some of them, they did this over 3 decades ago. So that was pretty cool. Was there inspiration from these types of people that encouraged you that you could do this?
Absolutely. I think as adventurous as I might think of myself, I had to look out to see that there are other people searching for the same, and that there are other people that have done it even in a more difficult way, if you will, maybe without any GPS and without any telephones. Helge Pedersen did 250,000 kilometers over a period of 10 years in 1982 to 1992. So, and he did it on the same bikes that we took. So that was a huge inspiration to know that this bike can make it, that you can do this trip with this motorcycle. And then knowing that solo female riders like Leah Reich or Sinje Gottwald or Kinga, I don't remember her last name, but have done this and are still traveling around the world by themselves, makes me, you know, inspired to follow their steps. But you know, to be honest, I have to say I am not sure that I am a solo traveler. So I do it my way, you know, and I think that's part of the thing. You get inspired, you look at them, but then you do you. You do your own version of that that makes sense for you. More camping, less camping, new bikes, old bikes, more off-road, less off-road, whatever it is. So I am a big advocate of listen to us, but do your thing. You know?
Totally. And so on this trip, you could have taken newer bikes, but you were determined to take these bikes that I believe were over 30 years old. Is that right?
Yes, they are.
So what is that all about?
What is that all about? Well, that is all about that you don't need a computer to diagnose our bikes. You don't need to plug a small computer. You don't have chips to deal with. You don't have sensors that once they break, if you're in the middle of the southern Bolivia in just the expansive sort of altiplano, you can't get that sensor. You can't plug your computer to your machine. But I can fix almost anything on the road with the tools and the spares and the knowledge that I carry with me. Less computerized things to me means more reliability. It's a simpler machine. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have adjustable suspension. It doesn't have a computer on board. But do you need all those things? To be honest, I saw a man do 5 continents and 250,000 kilometers without any of that. And I said, that's the type of trip I want to do. Also, because I have been learning from my friend Peter Boja here in Brooklyn over a period, I think like 6-7 years, how to maintain and repair these motorcycles. So why would I throw all that knowledge away and get myself a new bike that I don't know how to fix? And that's basically it. Besides that, these bikes have a soul. They have a feel to them that it just speaks to me. It just makes me want to be on them. In many ways, they're more rudimentary. They're more raw. They're more real. They're more honest. They're more sort of old school, if you will, you know. And some of my favorite objects are much older than me. You know, my saxophone is from 1965. A lot of the, you know, things that I that I love having around are very old. I think there's a sensitivity and sensibility and a balance between functionality and style that, to me, it's much more heightened in the older tradition of design and engineering than it is now. Of course, modern motorcycles are more precise. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not that I hate modern motorcycles. It's just they don't speak to me. And so that's it.
Yeah, I get this. I have a very old Italian racing bike, a road bike that I love to ride. And it's never failed me. And I've gone on some big rides with people who have beautiful, fancy, new, modern bikes, and they break down constantly. So yeah. I'm with you. I swear by my Italian, you know, Miele racing bike.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, that's one of the things everyone asks me is like, why would you take old bikes? Don't they break all the time? And I say, listen, do you think modern motorcycles don't break? How do you think BMW, Piaggio, Ducati make money after they sell you the bike? They're like, new bikes break as much, if not more.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
They are not built as much to last as long as they were before. A promise of the brands back there is you will be able to work on this bike and this bike will last you 40 years.
Yeah.
That was a promise.
Yeah.
Today, that's a promise. And I'm not getting into the, nitty-gritty of marketing and motorcycle manufacturing. I'm just saying there is a spirit to these bikes that touches me, and there is a reliability that if you understand your motorcycle a little bit, these bikes will go forever.
Mm, yeah, I love that. So this route, so you started from Brooklyn, New York, went down through Central America to South America. So obviously there's a bit of interest on your end due to having a family that is from Argentina. Is that completely why you chose this part of the country or this part of the world to do a trip like this?
It's a mix. I think that's one. Also, there is an element of romanticism of leaving my house. Literally my apartment. We went to sleep one night, and then the next morning we woke up and we said, well, we're riding to Argentina right now, and we closed the door and we brought the bags downstairs and we left my home and rode to, sort of my motherland, my country, my country where my family's from. And it's all connected through land besides the Panama Strait. And it just made sense to me that I would leave my house and go down south instead of other people choose to send their bikes to Ushuaia and ride back home. But for me, there was something beautiful about riding towards the unknown, not riding towards what you know from an unknown place. It just seemed obvious to me. I didn't have to think a lot about it. And if you think about it, you get the U.S., then you go through Mexico, you go to Central America, and then you go to South America. So there's a gradient of the things that I know. As we move south, the gradient becomes more the unknown the more we move.
Did you feel a different connection to Argentina than you did in other countries that you were driving through?
Absolutely. And it was very strange, and I didn't expect it at all. The day that we went through Chile, Atacama, and then we went into Argentina, I remember it very clearly. I got emotional. It's almost like when I saw it, I just felt I was home, which, by the way, I've never felt that way before. Hmm. And I never felt that way. I felt very happy being in Colombia or Ecuador or Peru, and I love Peru so much. Colombia is amazing. Bolivia was spectacular. But when I got to Argentina, I felt a sense of belonging, which was, I did not ever expect that. My parents are from Argentina. I'm not from Argentina, meaning I have a secondhand culture from Argentina, if you will. But it was very strange, very beautiful to feel at home after, having done 12 countries and almost. By the way, it's 30,000 kilometers, so 20,000 miles, 32,000 kilometers.
Oh, wow.
So at that point, probably we'd done around 24,000 kilometers. And it felt like, it felt like a beautiful moment of transition into a less unknown unknown, meaning it felt familiar, but I didn't know it well anyway.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. It's very interesting when you go somewhere and you just feel like you belong somewhere and you didn't ever anticipate that or you weren't projecting that. It just sort of happens to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How did you guys prepare for this trip, physically, mentally, emotionally, even with your bikes? What was that a big ordeal or was it pretty easy to put this all together to get out on the road?
I think I made it into a bigger ordeal than it was. I think that my personality has always been like improvisation and let's wing it and that'll be great. But then out of sort of perceived maturity, I thought, oh, I have to actually prepare for this thing. It's a big thing. I don't want to be winging all of this. So I went deep into research and into forums and these endless conversations, and I realized that I was getting, you know, nowhere, because you read and everyone has different opinions, of course, and it's like inconclusive information, which should be inconclusive because there's no point, you know. And I started realizing that there is just some things we can prepare and some things we cannot. What can we prepare? Are the motorcycles, our camping equipment, spares and tools, basic stuff, our clothing, and the route. The only thing you can do about the route before you leave, and this is a mix between mostly what I know now, but also we realized that we were trying to think about the route, and it's like, what are we going to think about what we're going to do in Colombia? We're not even there. We don't even know the place. We don't even know the roads. So what we did is just put stars on the map, literally throughout the entirety of the three parts of North, Central, and South America, and we would put, for example, Colombia, which is sort of like a squarish or roundish country, we would put stars everywhere, meaning either we have friends, we have places that we want to visit, or we've heard that there was something specific that was, you know, worth visiting. Never using any tourist guides, no traveler's guides, just word of mouth, friends, locals, but not like grabbing the Lonely Planet. See what Lonely Planet says, because you know that what Lonely Planet says is going to be full of a lot of people most of the time. And that's fine. That's fine for other people. But for us, we wanted to sort of explore, you know, also the more of the core, the countryside of this country. So we put stars everywhere. And we knew that if something didn't work, we were able to go in a different direction and still go to places that we wanted to travel. In the end, what we figured out is that there's very little you can plan on the route. And then you have to ask the locals and sort of go with the flow. And I know this sounds very cliche, but it's very, very true for motorcycle traveling of this length. So physically, we're terrible. Joel is actually a much more sporty guy, but we're not big into being super athletic. So we didn't do much, to be honest. But emotionally, I think we talked to a few people. I think there's something to be said about preparation and emotional. We were talking to people. And everyone was saying, oh, you're going through Mexico, or you're going through Honduras, or you're going through this place. There's all these things going on. And then I would say, have you been to Colombia? They're like, no. I was like, what? And then we started realizing that people were making us fearful of places they had not been to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a downer, to be very honest. So we stopped listening to people who had not been to the places or not done a trip on a motorcycle. This is very specific. Because everyone projects their own fear on your trip. And it wasn't very productive to me. So what we did is we started talking to people like Leah Reich or Jeremy Askinas, which have done the trips and have been in the places, and their perspective was completely different. And they would give us a lot of tips on different places to cross borders, places to go, and ways to think about the trip. And really that lifted us up and said, oh, that's the type of trip we want to do. It makes sense now, you know. But for a month or so, we were listening to advice that was not good. So that was sort of a change in the preparation, emotional preparation. But, you know, we're also risk takers, but not insane. So we have a balance between risk and reward and how much can we push the envelope. Just taking motorcycles through these countries is, let's say, risky enough.
Yeah.
So we tried to keep the other elements a little more.
Were you using maps or GPS or both? Like old
GPS.
School maps? Oh, GPS. Okay.
I mean, the idea of old school maps is cool.
Yeah.
But It's already hard enough.
Yeah.
For the Jews.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I think if it were 20 years ago, there was no choice and it would have produced a different trip. I have to only speak for what I know. And we were with literally our iPhones, our like phones and Google Maps. And Google Maps will take you to Ushuaia. That's how we did it. Seriously, that's how we did it. And we got lost a couple of times, but not because – I don't think it's because of Google Maps. I think it's because we just missed, you know, an exit or an entrance. And sometimes there's just no reception. So, mm-hmm. you know, you get lost. But getting lost is the point of the trip too. So
yeah.
It wasn't bad at all.
Did you have a strict schedule or was it every day you were kind of determining what you would do or what, if you were taking a day off or how many kilometers you needed to do that day? What was the plan like?
Never be strict on a trip like this. That's my motto because the point is to enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, it's to have fun, it's to let things flow. So sometimes Joel gets sick for 24 hours. Okay, I'm working on the bikes. I'm going to do a service on the bikes. I get sick for 24 hours. Well, you know, either Joel is taking care of me or he goes walk around and I sleep. But beyond that, also, sometimes we're like, this place is awesome. Let's stay another day. Okay, cool. That's about it. That's why the 6 months, if you try to do that with 4 months, I mean, that's going to be hard because mm-hmm. you got to ride every day, you know. And we didn't want to ride every day. And some days we rode 50 miles. Some days we rode 0 miles. Some days we rode 485 miles. And it really depends on what you're trying to do. Oh, someone is going to be in that place and we want to meet them and we want to stay with them. Or there's this celebration in this town, so we do more miles. Or we stay over the next day. Literally also, like, you get to places and or you spend time in a country that you love and you – you know, you leave countries that somehow don't have the energy that you're
thinking it would have.
Yeah. Vibrates with you and just, you know, just also that sort of like intuition, it's important, you know. You don't have to, you know, like museums when people look at every single painting like they need to like it.
Mm-hmm.
You should see me in a museum is the way I travel. If I don't like the painting, I don't care how famous it is. I'm yeah. just moving on.
Yeah.
Like, I don't trust to understand things that don't, you know, talk to me.
Yeah.
That's it. So that's how I travel. So in certain places, I just stay longer. And, you know, we discover places like Colombia, which, believe it or not, I didn't think much about Colombia. Like, but this is the beauty of discovery. Like, you know, I never really thought about Colombia. And it was one of the most incredible places. And the big underdog that I had zero expectations out of pure ignorance, by the way, was Bolivia, which to me is an incredible, incredible place in South America. And I am not sure what it's not spoken more about, but it really took me by surprise. And it really, and I'm enamored with Bolivia and also Peru. I mean, now I'm going to say the entire continent, but, Bolivia was just something else.
And did you have any issues with border crossings or were those smooth for you guys?
Well, you know, I think that people are scared. We were definitely scared of border crossings. Not anymore. Never again. You're not scared now. It's just, it's slow. It's full of paperwork. Some incoherent stuff. Like, why do you have to do all these things in different buildings? You get insurance like in that building and then you go to the other building to get this thing stamped and then you pay over there and you come back and it's like, seriously, guys, can you just put all of this in one place? No. And we don't know and we don't care, but we don't care to change their countries either. This is how it's done and it doesn't matter. And these countries still, for example, Central America and South America still love paper, like a piece of paper. It's like 1974 all over again, you know? And so, you know, okay, well, what we did, for example, I think my designer anal mind sort of did something which we actually got copies ahead of time. So we had all of our paperwork in color and black and white copies, everything, multiple times. So when they were like, oh, I need 3 copies of this, here you go. They're like mesmerized by how much paperwork we carry. By the way, it's all folded in a very neat small thing, but that would speed up everything. Because you think that every border crossing will have someone waiting for you to give you change at the local currency so you can get copies of your ID. So, you know, you can do all this in the, all of the copy machines, and every border crossing will always work because you are special and that's how it works. No. So we avoided that by just being prepared. And by the way, it's just paper, so it's not even a big deal. Easy. I think it was easy. It's just slow.
Yeah.
Most of the time it's boring, slow, and that's it. And hot sometimes. You know, I had one which I learned the hard way. In Costa Rica, there's these helpers, and they're wearing these white badges. The white badges don't say anything. They're just literally white badges, full white. And there's like 30 of them. And they're all men, and they're all around, and they're like, oh, let me help you. And you're like, okay, cool. You know, think about it. Central America is still the beginning of our trip. And there's a lot of people, and there's like a million American tourists in Costa Rica, of course, like buses and people walking around with 50 American passports. So it's like crazy. And this guy tells, okay, well, get your bikes here, park it, hire this guy, give him $5 so he looks at your bike while you're with me. Okay, Joel, you come with me, you, Matias, wait here. And I did something that I never do again, of course, is I gave him my passport and Joel's passport, and he was with Joel with the passports, and we were in this line, and I'm working on a different line. And before, he said, if you know, guys don't want to get your bikes inspected, we have to pay. He actually told me we have to pay the guy to not look at them, I think like $50 per bike. And then if you want to get insurance, also $50 per bike and something else, I forget now. It came up to like $250 to cross the border. I'm sitting there, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. So thanks to the fact that I speak Spanish, woman sitting at a desk, she's smiling at me. I smile, hey, how are you? Great. And I basically say what I just told you. She looks at me like I have like seven ears, you know, seven eyes. And she's like, no, it's free. And the insurance is $13 after you cross. Everything else is free. You just got to get your stamp here. And I just fuming. And I turn around, I look at the guy, and he tried to talk to me because he realized what was going on. I put my hand up and said, don't talk to me. Just give me my passports. Because I was fuming because he's taking advantage of people. And the worst part is I believe they're taking advantage of people because they're paying some sort of fee to be allowed to be in there.
Yeah.
Taking advantage of people. But that was my mistake, to be honest. I mean, everyone needs to make a living out of the way they can. So that's fine. But I find it to be that I was about to pay. And, you know, I came out in the top, but other people probably don't.
Yeah.
And that sucks because $250.
It's a lot.
Or one crossing, it's a lot of money,
yeah.
You know, and you get so many things, you know, it's days on the road.
Yeah.
So that was the worst, quote unquote, but nothing happened, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned earlier that often you were staying with friends or sometimes with locals. Was that usually what you did, or were you ever in hotels or camping or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, it was not. I mean, staying with friends is, you know, here and there, a few in the U.S., Argentina, Quito, and then in Peru. But really, really, it's a lot of motels. Not motel in the way we understand the American, you know, the U.S., sort of Canada, like the Motel 66, you know, no, the... Like
guest
posadas,
houses.
Like yeah. Casas, you know, the homes of people where you just, the hospitality is very different. Yes, we stay in hotels, we stay in small motels, in rustic, you know, houses in for example, in Guatemala, you know. I wanted to do more camping than we did. Let's say that Joel is a reluctant camper. It's true, and if he ever listens to this, he knows that's the truth. So he doesn't gravitate towards camping, but that's okay. But we camped a few times, and a lot of little hotels, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the smallest places, there's no signs for hotel, nothing. You just go to the bar or to the corner or to whatever person on the street, say, hey, do you know any? And we're talking about not even towns, villages with 900 people, okay? And you say, hey, do you know anyone renting a room? And they say, yes. Go to the third house on the left. Yeah. And that's cool because
yeah.
And you end up staying in very interesting places, you know, and that's part of the trip. And many times you just put your stuff, you take a shower, you go out, have dinner, hang out for a bit, go to sleep. The sleeping is, to me, the easy part.
Yeah.
I felt it was never an issue. And the worst case scenario, pitch your tent.
And what was the reaction of locals to the two of you coming through on these old motorbikes?
It, always big eyes and big sort of like, the first question is like, where are you guys from? And we said, we're Spanish, but say we're coming from Brooklyn. And their brain sort of stops because they don't understand what we're saying. And even in Costa Rica, like in Central America, their brain stops. Imagine where we're in Bolivia. And then a big smile, and you know, they want to know mostly two things: how much does the bike cost, and how fast does it go, and how big the engine is. You know, that those are the three constant questions. And where do you come from, and where are you going? But very, very open, very sort of generous humans along the way, and the reactions were always fantastic. People are out there to help you.
Yeah.
People think that, I don't know why, that people want to take from you because maybe they have less. And the interesting thing that I learned is that we believe that people that have less than us, and I said we just to put myself in you know, in that bucket of society, not to say you or, you know, us. Like, we believe that people who have less are poorer than us. It's a very basic monetary measuring system.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, neither are they poorer. They live different lives, maybe more humble lives. But who says that they need our, you know, work goals and career goals and making an impact and getting the second house upstate or our car in like this position and my title now is this?
Yeah.
It's
silly,
just
isn't it?
One living, you know?
Yeah.
They want live an honest life. They want to be loved. They want to give love. They want their children to be educated. They want their children to have love and give love and be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they need to be happy. I mean, I'm making big statements here, generalizations, but the way we live, that's one way. And it's not, to be honest, it's not the way most people live in this world.
I agree.
And if you travel enough, you realize that we are the exception.
Yes.
And living in this crowded cities, this thing, you know.
Yeah.
So
I agree, and I wouldn't say we're any happier, that's for sure. So yeah.
They're, by the way, they're more in contact with their land, they're a lot more in contact with their community, and they are a lot less in contact with social media and what other people have and what other people have achieved and what you have not achieved. So instead of focusing on what they don't have, they focus on what they have.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big difference of looking at life.
Totally. How long did it take you to adapt to this lifestyle? Even say if you go on a trip for a few weeks, it takes the first few days to get into the groove. How long did it take for you to acclimatize to this new type of living that you were doing?
That's a very good point, very good question. I think it took, to be honest, I think it took a month. It took a month to really get off the phone in many ways. For the first 2 weeks, I was still connected to the phone, you know, sort of texting friends and, you know, just feeling like maybe that was a safety blanket for me. And I'm saying this retrospectively, you know, looking back and being honest with myself, I think it took a while, you know, even in Mexico. But then I think after we left the US, which was 3 weeks, in the middle of Mexico, you start getting used to also packing and unpacking and looking for places and pitching your tent and, you know, just being on bikes. Also, my back hurt for 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks, and I thought, my lower back, and I thought, wow, if this is for months, this is miserable. But then your body gets stronger just because, you know, you're exercising certain muscles that are sort of motorcycle muscles in that way. But also emotionally, like, I think it took a month to really be on the trip, like fully immersed and just sort of stop thinking about anything else but the next day and where we were going. And then there's another stage, I would say, when we were in Colombia after all of Central America. I mean, I was in it. I was just in a different wavelength, you know. I was like completely into this trip, and all the way till the last day, and all the way almost until I came back. When I came back, I was still in Argentina in my head, you know.
Yeah. It's hard to come back after something like that, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. And so what kind of weather and what kind of terrain on the roads were you dealing with for those 6 months?
It rains a lot in Central and sort of north of South America, Colombia and Ecuador and even Peru a little bit. Peru was when we started seeing the rains stop. Colombia rains every other day, not every day. For example, in Central America, the rainy season, the weather changes a lot. But that type of weather where it rains for 3 hours and then sun is shining and then rains for another 2 hours, that's the weather there. So instead of saying, oh, that's a bummer, I mean, if you don't want that, then don't go to that country. It's almost like not wanting to eat spicy food in countries where they love spicy food. It's like, why did you go there? You have to sort of take it on as what it is. So they rained a lot, but you get used to it. And later on, after maybe a month of that, I actually found a lot of peace in the rain. Of course, you slow down and you're riding much slower, but we have waterproof everything. So the rain, like the rain on the window, you know, it gave me a lot of peace and, you know, sort of very beautiful as well to be riding on rain. If you, you know, by the way, we're going very slow and very safe because we know the dangers of it. But then if you go there, Colombia, the north of Colombia is very wet, but then you go to the Tatacoa Desert, Cañón de Chicamocha, and it's, you know, 39 degrees in the shade or 40 degrees and you're burning and you have to keep moving. Not only you're sweating your soul off, but also you're like, it's really, really hot. Then you go through the, for example, the Altiplano of Bolivia and you are up 4,600 meters and there's no seasons at that height. So when the sun hides, it's extremely cold. It, you know, and then you go through Atacama in the north of Argentina and it's hot and dry. And by the way, people think, oh, I would love to find dirt roads because we love off-roading as well as much as we need some days off-road because you get tired also of off-roading. But you will find, this is not North America. In Colombia, in Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, everywhere, Argentina, you will find dirt roads even if you want to avoid them, unless you're taking highways. But I don't know why you would take a motorcycle trip on highways anyway. But if you're taking smaller roads, eventually you're going to hit so much dirt that, you know, you don't even have to think about it. So, yeah, it was a massive variety. I mean, you got the Colombian forest, you got Guatemala, which is an incredible country. Then you have the beautiful, expansive lands of Bolivia. You have the mountains of Peru. Peru is all mountains. It's an incredible place. Mm-hmm. And you have the Patagonia, the Argentinian sort of like flatlands and the wind and I don't know. You hit almost every ecosystem known to man.
Yeah. And did your bikes break down too much or were they in pretty good condition throughout the trip?
They were pretty good. They treated us well. We prepared them very well. So we did a full roundup of everything before leaving. We had 6 flats, 5 on my bike and 1 on Joel's, which is just coincidental, you know. Mm. Then while we were riding on the salt flats of Peru, that year was very rainy, so they were flooded, which is common as well. And they maybe have 10 centimeters of water, maybe a little less. And salt water and electrical doesn't really go well. So Joel's coil, which had been acting up, which we didn't know at the time, but looking back, I knew, just stopped working. I didn't know there was the coil until we had to look through it in the middle of a salt flat, a flooded salt flat. But that was the moment in which everything I learned from my friend Peter came into focus and I was able to troubleshoot and get us out of there instead of trying to get someone to tow you in the middle of a flooded salt flat. You see, like, you don't know what you're going to break down, modern or old. You never know what you're going to break down. So there's certain things like changing a tire, a tube, and understanding the basics of your motorcycle. I mean, if the transmission had blown up there, I can't fix it, cannot. So there's limits to that. But the bikes were really reliable. We were extremely careful. I was extremely careful in doing way more services than required. So I did full oil change, valve adjustment, and sort of basic checkups, I think 6 times over 30,000 miles, which is a lot. But at the same time, the bikes made it all the way down. My bike actually had no mechanical issues whatsoever. Joel's had only the coils situation. So
they made it. And are they still able to go on another trip, these bikes, or is that it for them?
One thing that I don't know if you know, I had an accident in Bolivia.
I did not know that. What happened?
So, well, that only the Bolivian gods know what happened there. But what I know is that my front tire, I got what we call a tank slapper. So my front tire started going side to side. We were in a dirt road. I think we were going a little bit too fast. We were overloaded, and I hit a pocket of sand with my, this is my conjectures. I don't know if this is true, but I'm guessing that's what it was. My front tire hit a pocket of sand and maybe didn't rebound fast enough and then start slapping side to side. And when you start slapping side to side, you're basically not holding the handlebars any longer. And the bike literally flew over me and was inverted.
Oh, my God.
There's a picture of this in my Instagram and in the book. The bike actually did a 360, 180. So it's like a kickflip in the air, I think. I don't know if this is the correct skateboard. But skateboard fans, please forgive me. But the bike actually, and this is a testament to, I think, the way they were designed, I wasn't able to ride it that day because some of the electrical got sort of discombobulated, the full front fairing exploded. Also, I was a little, you know, shocked, and I lost sort of memory for those two first hours. I don't remember anything beyond what I've seen on the video, which luckily I was randomly. We recorded maybe 20 minutes a day if you are 8 hours on the road, and those 20 minutes I was filming. So I filmed my own fall.
Oh, God.
That's how I learned some of it. And then I spent 3 days afterwards fixing the bike, not because it took 3 days, it's just because I was in pain and I was slow and I was giving myself time, purposelessly being slow and conscious, not only because I was processing everything emotionally, but also I was trying to get better physically as I was trying to fix the motorcycle. And I put it back together, sort of did a plastic surgery in the bike, and the bike made it another from Bolivia to the south, which is another 8,000 kilometers more or less. Something like that. And right now, today, I'm rebuilding the entire bike because we're thinking of going on another big trip with my friend Sinje. So
cool.
Yeah.
But did that accident? Did you find it hard to get back on the bike? Were you not a little bit more nervous, or you were okay after those 3 days?
No, definitely. I think, to be fully honest, I think there are still remainders of that are still haunting me. You know, like I don't feel 100% like I used to feel, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I feel that it gives me a sense of, it sort of resets the balance of risk, sort of the measure of what, you know. That day I was going fast. I was following this very good off-road rider, Simone, who we had met a few days before. And, you know, there was an ego element there where it's sort of like, oh, he's going that fast, I can go that fast. And I couldn't. And he's a better off-roader. I'm a better rider on the road. And I should have known that. I should have said, you know what, we're going to go slower. And I sort of sense that. So there's a combination of all these things. I'm saying this because you're asking me, you know, was it easy? So I knew that it was my fault. You know, there was no truck running me over. It was my fault. It was a deserted off-road, you know, track in Bolivia. So I could have gone slower. So it was a mixed feelings when I had to get back on the bike. I decided, we talked about this. Joel said, hey, do you want to continue, you know? And I said yes immediately because I knew the back of my mind that if I didn't finish this trip, I would have regretted it for the rest of my life. But not only in 10 years, I would probably regret it 3 months after coming back.
Yeah.
And my mom, you know, has always been a big advocate of me pushing certain limits. I remember when I was 18, for example, I went to India, no credit cards, just enough money for a month. And I call her, I was 18, and I call her and I said, this is hard, it's a strange land, I've never been outside of Barcelona before, and I went to India. And she said, Matias, you're there, you have 2 more weeks, just get on with it, enjoy it, just find the ways and the beauty of it. And I remember that, and so I took it on, and I said, you know what, we're doing this. And it was a strange feeling getting on the bike. I wasn't scared but I was, I can't even describe it. I think it's a very hard feeling to describe.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed emotions, but it changed the way we, you know, we took it easy. We just slowed down a little bit, you know. We were a little less confident, not in the right way,
yes.
in the right amount, in the right direction, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that is very, was very valuable, not only for motorcycling, but for my life as well.
Tell us about, sometimes the world works in mysterious ways, doesn't it? Tell us about Africa. What is this new venture all about?
What is this? Well, Africa is just sort of the ultimate adventure motorcycling place. And I believe it's where we all come from. And there's a beauty in the challenges, the beauty in the how much land mass it is and how big it is. And there's 55 countries or so in Africa. And as much as they're part of one continent, they also have their own idiosyncrasies, cultures, languages, rituals. You know, it just feels like it's going to be an incredible journey, challenging as well, but incredibly beautiful. And my friend Sinje Gottwald and I sort of been talking about it for a bit, and she wanted to do it, but she didn't want to do it alone, and I understand why. I wanted to do it, but Joel has sort of retired from the motorcycle adventure.
Oh.
So yeah, he asked, you know, I asked him, he said, nope, I'm out. And so, you know, it just came that decided that Sinje and I should do it. And I think it's going to be around, it's early 2020, so February, March. We're still figuring out weather patterns and all the stuff, and visas and a lot of stuff to be decided. But yeah, it's a very exciting thing to think about. So now, literally, we're preparing the bikes to go to Mexico, hopefully at the end of the week, probably beginning of next week. One test, our road chemistry, you know, because being friends and being able to be on the road is very different things. And testing our road chemistry and also testing the bikes. My bike has been sitting for 2 years. I think there was something that kept me away from it. I think the accident in Bolivia, which led the third leg of the trip, the end of it, sort of, it affected me. So I sort of gave it some time to heal. And I'm ready to get back on the road. So I'm rebuilding most of it. And Africa seems to be where we're going.
And so would it be another 6 month venture? Is that what you're looking at?
Maybe even longer, to be honest.
Ooh.
I think there is a chance that we'd do Africa and we'd take our bikes through Asia, meaning let's say that you go east coast of Berlin, Morocco, then all the way to South Africa, then you go up the east coast up into, let's say, Egypt, and then you cross to Turkey, and then from there you make it east all the way to Tokyo, Japan, and crossing Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Mongolia, Russia, China, and then South Korea, where Sinje is half Korean, half German. So, and we both love Tokyo, Japan. So I don't know. That's sort of the rough plan so far.
That's a big plan.
That's big,
a big one.
You know?
Yeah. Go big or go home.
And exactly. And eventually, like, there's two legs to the trip, and hopefully, you know, the minimum I think that we want to do is do Berlin to South Africa. And that sounds like, feels like an achievement. And then we'll go from there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there are the two legs, like the East Africa and then the whole Asia part. So you break it down. You don't try to say we're doing Berlin to Tokyo via Africa. That's just a little crazy.
Yeah.
Think about it like that.
Yeah. And so for you, what is the appeal of traveling by motorbike? Why do you do it?
Well, traveling on a motorcycle really connects you with sort of the context, the terrain that you ride. You're so much more in contact with nature, and you don't have a roof over your head. So there's an expansiveness and a freedom feeling. Also, you're not talking, you're not listening to music. I mean, you're almost 100% feeling the moment in which you are in. I think when you're in a bus or you're in a car or you're in a train, you can read, you can be on your computer and your phone, and that's totally fine. But the motorcycle seems to be this very intense connection with the journey itself. With every mile, you physically have to be active every mile that you do. Otherwise, you fall. It's not even in a car that you can sort of zone out. A motorcycle, you zone out very little. And there is a meditational element to motorcycling that I go through in sort of the longer, less challenging roads. And it's also so flexible. You can put your bike on a boat. You can get your bike out of a ditch. You can get your bikes into the living room, which I have done plenty of times, of homes and hotels. You can do so many things on a motorcycle that you cannot do with a two-ton car. And there's so many convenient things about car traveling and other things. I think for us, motorcycling is just the only way that I feel truly alive.
We have to wrap up, sadly, although I feel like we could continue this conversation. Is there anything you would like to share with listeners before we go?
Yeah, I always think about this. I feel that we are following at times the path that makes common sense. And I think common sense is a very dangerous thing because common sense is generic and it doesn't apply to the individuals. I feel that we are spending our lives working and not tending to other beautiful parts that life offers. Being on the road is actually cheaper than being on any city. Being on the road will give you tools that will make you better at your job if you actually want to continue doing what you do by multiples. Nothing's going to happen if you leave your job now and take an adventure because you can always come back to the same thing you were doing, if you will. And I don't think most people that take on a big adventure come back the same and do the same. I urge people to try to rethink, when do they believe they're going to be able to do something like this? And it is actually easier than they believe. You don't have to be a seasoned motorcyclist. You don't have to be a seasoned camper. You don't have to even know how to read a map, but it's taking the first step towards it. I think it's an incredibly rewarding life experience that will change the way that you see and experience the world, your friendships, your family, and what do you do with your time in this, the time that is given to you on this earth. And I think for me, it did a few things. It resolved, it closed some doors. I asked for forgiveness. I forgave. I cried. Also came back with a lot new questions. And I think the only way to move forward is with questions that you can resolve or try to find answers to. So I think that taking a journey like this is something that everyone should do at least once in their lifetime.
Oh, this is a good way to close. Thank you so much, Matthias. That was beautiful. And I love those sentiments. And it's very important. Everyone should pay attention to that because we are in a time where we need to take a pause and reevaluate what we are doing. So thank you so much for joining us here on Fly. It's been an absolute pleasure. I want to remind people, you have a beautiful book called Two Wheels South, so they can look that up. And the pictures are stunning, so people should definitely check that out. Your website is also very, very interesting. Lots of information there and interesting information about some of the people that inspired you. So again, Two Wheels South. So again, we have been with Matthias Correa, who spoke to us today from Brooklyn, New York. And we'll be following you, checking you on your next adventure to Africa. That's very exciting. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a true pleasure.
Fly.